Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Art of Tracking Radio Show. Tracking is still alive and well. Join us as we interview master trackers from around the world. We'll hear their stories, their secrets. So tune in and enjoy all you hear. Welcome.
Welcome to the Art of Tracking Radio Show. Today we have Casey McFarland on. He's a senior tracker in the cyber tracker evaluation process. We're going to be talking to him about his book that he co-authored called Bird Feathers, A Guide to North American Species. We're excited to have Casey back on the show. Well, thanks for coming back on the show again, Casey.
Thanks for having me, Garth. It's really good to be back.
Great. And today we're going to be talking about bird feathers. You got a book here that you co-authored called Bird Feathers.
That's correct.
And I really enjoy this bird. One of the things I really enjoy finding skulls and feathers when I'm out in the forest. And so today I want to know what we can learn from a feather.
Sure thing. Yeah. Well, it's the same for me, and I think that finding feathers is a point of fascination for people the world over. Seems like we've always been kind of intrigued when you see a feather blowing around and run over and pick it up and kind of just marvel at it. And so the process for us was as surprising as you could imagine, I guess, in terms of what you can actually tell about a feather. And I think that when Dave and I began down this journey, for one, we knew very little of feathers. It was more of just a general intrigue that was leading us down this path. And then what was really cool as wildlife trackers is that, you know, as I started learning more and more about what a feather can tell, I started realizing how similar it was to finding a track or a skull on the ground, but even a track. And as wildlife trackers, as everyone listening knows, that, you know, when we come across something in the field, say we're out in a big sea of desert and we come across a badger track or a ground squirrel, we can look down and see this distinct, powerfully built, asymmetrical foot with long digging claws, and we begin to get an idea of how that particular animal interfaces with planet Earth. Yeah. And through the morphology of that design, we learn all kinds of things about how it fits into the big scheme of things. And feathers are the exact same way, in a sort of subtle, surprising way. And the more we know about a feather shape, suddenly it begins to tell a story about the wing that it fit within, and then what that wing does in the world, which tells a story about what that bird does in the world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You mentioned somebody's name. You said Dave. You're talking about the co-author of your book, Dave Scott?
That's correct. That's okay. Correct. Dave Scott.
One of the things I saw in your book that I did not know until I was looking in your book, it says that birds have a different kind of respiratory system. Or they like take two breaths for one actual cycle of breathing?
Exactly. Yeah, that was one of the fascinating things too, was learning, you know, really beginning to explore the fact that just because birds have feathers doesn't mean they can fly. And many birds, you know, that look pretty similar to other birds are actually flightless, and they have heavier builds or heavier bones. And so much of the capability of flight that you find in birds is actually because of their whole entire physical design. And so their respiratory system is amazing. They're little endurance athletes to the max. And so generally speaking, they have huge hearts. You know, you get a little sparrow who's got a heart that's three times the size of a mammal of the same weight. And then they have these respiratory systems where not only do they have lungs, but they have these air sacs. And so when it's this very interesting cycle where they're breathing in and then expelling air from one of the air sacs deeper down in the system. And it's the sort of cyclical thing that's providing lots of oxygen throughout the system, and it's actually tied directly into their skeleton. they have pneumatic bones. So these little air sacs are all tied in, and so they're getting oxygen right into their very bones, which is pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
So, and also, just on that note, there's something really cool, too, that they're now finding evidence of that in some dinosaurs. So,
oh, wow.
An old system.
Yeah. So if I have a feather in front of me, what are the what are some of the terminologies for the parts of that feather?
Well, basically, the overall morphology of the feather, as to where it sits on the bird. You know, you basically how we're breaking things down is there are flight feathers. So there are feathers of the wing, which are primaries and secondaries, and then feathers of the tail. And then pretty much everything else you can lump into body feathers, which, you know, we don't really need to get into. And then the feather itself, of course, is broken down into parts. There's the quill, which is the support structure for the entire thing, and then the feather webs or veins that are all tied together with a small interlocking zipper system with little hooklets and things of that nature. So without getting too into all the technical terms, that's the basics of it.
Yeah, I noticed that in your book you have a page that or a couple pages that breaks them down into six different types, where you get like a contour feather,
yep.
Down. They actually have feathers that were that they use for feeling, almost like whiskers, which I had no idea about, which are
the bristle feathers.
Bristle feathers, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, super cool. So you get little birds like nightjars, or you know, and whippoorwills, these diving insect feeding birds, and they'll have these little protective whiskers around their eyes. Woodpeckers have those as well, because they're of course just hammering holes in the wood, and you get little chunks of debris flying everywhere, and apparently that can help not only feel out where they're at in relation to the hole they're building or whatever it is, but it also protects their eye from flying obstacles.
Now, there was another word in your book, I'm not even sure how to say it, but it had something to do with the growth pattern of the feathers as they're coming out of the skin, like
yes. Okay, now you're making me reach way back into the memory bank.
Yeah. It started,
I think it's called petrolysis.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh God, I'm butchering it. There goes all my credibility. But no, yes, so that's really interesting too, and that refers to the actual overall pattern that the bird's body is actually not entirely feathered, meaning there, you know, if you were to look at a mammal with hair, there would actually be distinct patterns of hair, symmetrical patterns of hair, but what's happening is the feathers are actually growing from the skin in such a way that the entire body is covered, but not all of the surface area of the skin actually has feathers coming out of it.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. So you were mentioning that birds, different kinds of birds, have different shaped wings, which for different kind of flying, like a forest-type bird may have a different shape wing than, say, a soaring bird up in the sky. And how does that, can you see that reflection if you were to find just a single feather, say a flight feather? Could you tell what kind of wing shape that came from? I think you had four different kinds of wing shapes, is that right?
Correct. Yeah, you basically have the elliptical wing shape, which is one we're very familiar with because all the little passerines, all you know, robins and all the birds that perch in trees type of thing, and then our game birds, quail and turkeys and grouse and birds of that nature all have these little elliptical sort of fan shapes. If you can imagine just a regular fan, they kind of have this very equally wide, equally long type wing. And then we've got things like the high-speed wing, which is sort of shaped like a boomerang that you see in swallows or in some of the little falcons. And then the soaring wings like pelicans and red-tailed hawks, and then the, what's the other one here? I actually can't recall the other one off the top of my head.
There was the angular high-speed slotted.
Yep, the slotted high-lift.
High-ratio like albatross? That's the boomerang.
Yes, the soaring wing. And so, or I'm sorry, the gliding wing. So these are like albatross. And even things like seagulls have that, which is funny because a seagull wing begins to kind of get into the high speed wing, but they're just a little bit longer. They have a high aspect ratio, as they call it, which is the length of the wing compared to its width. And so, you know, those are those wings where basically it's as if our own forearm were stretched out twice as long as we normally would see it, and it's entirely covered with lift feathers, which is kind of cool, as opposed to a very shortened forearm in your more high-speed or elliptical game bird, or elliptical wing shapes.
Another aspect I always feel confused about, is there a time of year when you can find more feathers than other times? And I was trying to figure, like, do birds molt at a certain time, or is that like different for all kinds of birds? Or
it's a good question. It actually is different for lots of different birds. There are some patterns, and to be honest, I can't there are particular times of year that happens. What I do know is that some birds will do a full molt once a year. A few select species will do two full molts a year. Generally speaking, birds will lose their feathers over and replace them over about a 3 or 4 month period. And but then some birds, like geese and things like that, certain species can actually do they'll pretty much drop a lot of their feathers at once. And they kind of just remain grounded. And what they have concluded about this strategy is that some birds, you know, when you get these heavy-bodied birds like a goose, even the loss of a few feathers can increase that already very taxing high energy expenditure, and it just makes it not worth it to fly around because it's too hard, so to speak. And so they kind of hide out. Do a quick remolt, a whole makeover, if you will, and then get back to it. So yes, it's all different across many different birds.
And another thing that I really found interesting that I had no idea about before I was looking at your book is that the pigments, the colors of the feather, actually give the feather different strengths and weaknesses, and
yes.
And they actually deteriorate at different rates. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, you'll see some birds like gulls, and this can actually be reverse, which is interesting, but some birds will have a white flight feather, say, but it will have a black tip. And generally speaking, black and our dark colors are associated with melanin, which is pretty much a keratin, and so it's a stronger structure. And so, obviously, it's the tips of feathers that are, because feathers overlap and can kind of protect each other along their body, the tips of the feathers are just getting exposed to a lot of forces of flight, a lot of wind and wear and rain and that kind of deal, weather. And so they will wear out sooner. So a lot of birds actually have darker tips, and you'll see that in gulls, like I mentioned, quite often. And so that reinforces those sort of higher exposure ends of the feathers.
That I really like that. That's fascinating to
me.
Yeah,
it's cool.
So you can
built-in armor.
Yeah, totally. And then there's certain blue colors, like maybe in the jays, I think that wasn't actually blue that we're seeing, or a pigment, right? It was like
exactly
just the way the light, something with the lighting and how they're made.
Yeah, so what they started doing, so the pigment is really cool and really fascinating. There's things, I can't remember all of the different pigment types. There's a few basic pigment types that are you know, contribute to bird color. And so there's carotenoids, which are found entirely, exclusively, as far as I remember, in plant life that birds like cardinals are eating. They get them from berries, which will give them their red color. And then things like flamingos are eating shellfish and things like that and picking up colors. And so a lot of times you're getting these natural substances that are contributing to the pigmentation of the feather. And, but then what they discovered with blue feathers, that if you were to break down the actual structure of a blue feather, the color goes away, as opposed to a pigment where the, you know, the, in the baseline structure, the pigment is there, the color is there. But what they, and I can't remember all the specifics of this, but basically in the nanostructure, in the very, very fine molecular buildup of blue feathers, the way that the structure is such that it is capturing light and reflecting it in such a way that it is sending the color blue to the eye. And like if you grind it up, that will go away, which is just kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, feathers are pretty amazing. And what can we tell from, say, a bird's, the stress that a bird has gone through in its life? Like I see these, and you got a book or a section on fault bars where you can actually like, look at the feather kind of under the light and see a particular line, and that has to do with the stress the bird's been in?
Correct. Yeah, so when you look at feathers, and a lot of birds have this, a lot of feathers have this, but you'll see these little lines that often they can go across just a part of the feather, and they're usually going straight out, sort of along, as opposed to the length of the feather. They often go across the feather, and you'll just see these little lines where it looks like there's just not as much material there as on the rest of the feather, and as you were saying, if you hold it up to the light, you can basically see through this little line in a feather. And so what's happening there is that while the feather is developing, you can all number of stresses can create these little fault bars. And it could be similar to the way our fingernails can get lines in them or dimples, depending on the health of our overall body. And so it's just kind of a fun thing to be able to pick up a feather and see these and wonder as to what happened, whether that bird just got freaked out or it hit a window or you know, escaped capture by a cat, or it didn't have enough food for a little while, or whatever it was. And you can also tell, you know, if you find a kill, say, with a scattering of feathers, and a whole lot of them have symmetrical fault bars across them, it will often show you that, you know, this was a young bird who, as it was developing all of its feathers, they were basically receiving the same fault bars at the same time, as opposed to what we just mentioned with a bird that replaces a few feathers at a time. And so that can tell you a few things. And one thing that's good for us as wildlife trackers when we're looking at bird kills is that very often people will mistake fault bars for, say, the beak marks of an accipiter, like a sharp-shin hawk or a Cooper's hawk, where, like, the, you know, the idea being that, well, maybe these two little lines were made where the beak clamped down in addition to the claws pulling feathers out, the, you know, the assistance of the beak to help pull some feathers out. And so it's just a good thing to know as a characteristic that you can find on feathers.
Yeah.
Think about.
Speaking of feather damage, that is fun. Out on Savi Island, I get quite a bit of find bird kills and things like that. And I'm always trying to figure out, well, who killed this bird? And I'm not too good at that, but I've seen that, like, some of the feathers, if they're clipped off at the base, like they look like they've been cut, that's more of a something you'd find a mammal doing, whereas if a raptor killed the bird, it would pluck it out with its beak.
Yep, exactly, and that always is really excited. I actually ran an evaluation, the Cyber Tracker evaluation in Colorado this weekend, and just on that note about bird kills, I found 6 or 7 bird kills in my scouting. I ran all around Boulder, Colorado area. And so, you know, they are out there and they're always telling a cool story, not only by the feathers themselves and figuring out where they were on the body, which, of course, as you guys all know, is a common question on evaluations, who is it and where from. And but then also, you know, we're able to tell a lot about who possibly killed it. And the general breakdown there is we're looking for evidence of it being inside of a mammal's mouth, because many mammals don't have the finger dexterity, if you will, to pull feathers out. And so they can hold them down with paws and are grabbing big clumps of feathers and either pulling them out, which is going to be leaving some damage on the feathers themselves, as well as kind of a slobbery nature. So parts of the feather veins are sticking together, gumming together. Whereas your accipiters, who are a very common kill to find, those killed by other predatory birds, very often what they're doing is they're reaching in with their claws and they're just yanking out big clumps of feathers. And things like sharp-shinned hawks and Cooper's hawks do this on the ground very often, which can be confusing. And yet you can just look down, and if you're looking down and you see very little shearing, so the quills are just not really cut or they're not slobbery and damaged, but you're finding lots and lots of full-length feathers with very little damage on them. They look like clean feathers plucked out. You can almost always assume that this was the work of a bird and not a mammal.
Okay, that's good. So on an eval, some feather type questions we would have is if you found a kill, it would be if a mammal killed it or if a raptor killed it. And you'd have questions on which type of feather it is, if it's a flight feather, a body feather, or a tail feather. How would you tell a tail feather from a flight feather or a wing feather?
Sure. So this actually gets back to a question we began to address before we sort of dove into wing types. And so just to bring it around in big picture again, as we learn a wing type and learn the types of flight that it provides to the bird and different ecological niches that are good for, obviously a gliding wing is great for soaring over ocean currents and things like that, whereas the elliptical wing is perfect for flitting around, high maneuverability, easy takeoff in brushy country or forested environments. And so as we learn these different wing types, which are actually very, very easy and straightforward to learn, we then begin to pick apart the morphology of the feathers within that, because obviously a feather shape or a wing shape consists of numerous feathers with distinct shapes to make up that overall wing shape. And so as we begin to break this down, it actually becomes fairly straightforward to be able to pick up a feather and say, oh, look at that shape. I know that this shape fits within this type of wing. This is a secondary from a gliding wing. Look how it's really short. It's sort of top-heavy, meaning the end of the feather opposite the quill, where it attaches to the bird, is bigger than where the quill is, and it's heavily curved. That's so cool. That's got to be, a secondary. And so we learn a few basic shapes, and we can begin first to understand the overall feathers within a wing. And then there are, of course, differences between tail feathers and primaries and secondaries. And it's one of those things that we really need visuals to point out. Once we can see it, like when you're looking at the pages in the book, you begin to get a feel for what to look for. But basically, we can begin to look for general shapes or features on the feather, like slotting or what we call notches, where on the leading primaries, say, of passerines or on hawks, there's these distinct feather shapes on the trailing vein that allow wind to cut through, to pour through the surface, basically that fingery look at the end of a hawk wing. And so we can just start adding up all these different features that will tell us, okay, this came from this type of wing. It's this type of feather on the wing. It's a primary or a secondary. And then we begin to get into tail feathers. And there's really only two different types of tails, what we call curved tails or straight tails. And they will also have distinct features that you can look for, that you can pick up and be like, okay, that looks like a curved tail from a goose, say, or wow, look at that long straight feather. This is a tail feather. One of the other things we look for on straight tails in particular is that the quill shape itself is different, in that it makes this funny little kind of a step down, as we call it. So instead of it being a straight quill, at the end where it attaches to the bird, it kind of dives down and then straightens out again. So we can look at that feather in cross section and be like, oh, look at that, that's a tail feather, and add that to our understanding of other characteristics. And so again, it's just a process of beginning to weed these things out, and just like tracking, we understand the basics of what we're looking for, wing types and tail types, and then looking at these features on smaller and smaller scales.
And one of the things I'm wondering about is, are feathers alive? Or, I mean, as soon as they grow to their full size, you know, the bird molts or whatever,
mm-hmm.
do those fault bars, are they happening during the molting process, or are they after, like, the wing is fully grown?
That's a great question. So what happens is there, you know, as a feather is growing, and when you find... You say you find a little fledgling bird that got killed. You probably know, you know, when you find those feathers, and they call them blood feathers. And so there's a feather down at the quill where it attaches to the bird. There's this weird sheath, and it's filled with dark, gooey, black blood, basically. And so, and you can see where it kind of wraps up, and it's kind of a neat process. That feather is sort of blossoming out of, you know, out of the quill as it's growing. So the feather veins are sort of opening up closer and closer to the quill, and that is when the feather is alive. So it's actually, you know, if you look at a feather and you look down at the quill, it's a solid piece. The end of the quill has been, unless it's been somehow damaged or broken, it's a closed object. So the feather is basically airtight. But when it's growing, the end of that quill is actually open to the flesh of the bird, and that's where it's getting all of its blood and nutrients and everything it needs to develop. And as soon as that feather is developed, much like an antler, that process stops and it closes off and it becomes a distinctly separate process. It's basically an ornament hanging from the flesh, if you will.
Wow.
And so during the development, when that feather is open and sucking up nutrients from the body itself, that's when fault bars are being created.
Okay.
And so, but as soon as that feather is done, those fault bars are going to be no more. However, because feathers are wearing naturally, those fault bars could begin to become more and more accentuated.
Right. So they weaken as they wear.
Exactly. Exactly. And in fact, a lot of times as a feather gets old, if those fault bars are pronounced enough, that's where the feather will break. And so, you know, you'll often find feathers, like, or if you find a crow that's been hit by a car and you're checking it out, and you're like, wow, check it out, a couple of its primaries, one over here and a secondary over on this side, they're broken, you know, two-thirds or a third of the way down the feather, and they're generally these nice, even breaks where it looks like you took scissors and cut the top of the feather off, and that broke or wore away at that fault bar, which is neat. And so the other cool thing about feathers is once they're done, you know, they don't cause the bird pain, so to speak. We talked to rehab people, you know, wildlife rehab people that gave us a lot of our specimens, and they did the coolest thing. They would get a bird that got, you know, smacked by a car, like a blue jay, say. In fact, this was an example they gave. And a whole bunch of its flight feathers were broken. And so what they did is they snipped off the feather at the broken part, leaving the part that still had integrity. And then what they would do is they would do these little shims with like toothpicks, and they actually attached flicker feathers to its wing.
No way.
And glued them in and basically rebuilt this little blue jay with some flicker parts, or it was vice versa, I don't remember what, and let it and sent it back into the world, and off it flew. Probably a little lopsided, but seemed to be all right when it took off. And so that's just kind of cool stuff.
That is amazing. So you can, like, graft on feather parts.
And that's what these folks have learned
wow.
to do. Yeah.
So one more thing I think we should talk about before we wrap up here is it legal to take feathers home? I know there's many birds that you can't just keep feathers you find. Is that right?
That's correct. Many game bird feathers, or, you know, basically birds that we can hunt, that's okay. What folks should know is that for the most part, pretty much, you know, across the board, wildlife parks, all those little nature museums on people's dashboards tend to be pretty illegal.
Yeah.
It's not highly enforced, but you just never know. So it's good to be conscious of that you're actually not supposed to have that blue jay feather. And some of these rules, of course, have gotten, they're somewhat outdated. They were put into place in the early 1900s when there was just all out, slaughter basically of tons and tons of species, and there was some serious decline across a wide variety of species, and so those were put into place as protection, and it worked really wonderfully. It was a great example of conservation, mass conservation, and effort that had huge impacts on rebounding our wildlife populations. But yeah, so it's good to know, and you can get salvage permits and things of that nature, especially running schools. But it's a good thing to know that a bunch of that stuff that we carry around so casually is actually,
yeah, be careful. Yeah.
Frowned upon.
Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to share all this knowledge you have with us.
And yeah, Gus, my pleasure.
I really encourage people to get this book, Bird Feathers. It's a field guide to identifying feathers, but it's also so much more. It talks about all this other stuff we've been talking about too. So I recommend it. And thanks for talking with us.
Absolutely, Garth. It's my pleasure.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.